watch Skinamarink in what I believe to be the best possible way, which is on a cold, gloomy Monday night in a forgotten theater in New Jersey with one of my best friends, who is an avid horror fan. On top of it being like cold, gloomy Monday night, like it was raining, it was like a little chilly. We were the only ones in the theater. I really felt like I was there. And yeah. I was like screaming out for the kids, like, don't go up there. like, Kevin, are you okay? I felt so connected to them. And at the same time being like, what is going on? What's happening to us? Because we were there with them, essentially abandoned in our own way. You know how dark theaters get, where you like, you just see the one glowing exit sign, and that's what we had. So it was an experience. And we're here. The ghouls next door. Talking about spooky things. Spooky
stuff and things, yeah.
Like the darkness and what could be lurking in it.
Yeah, where you don't get to like see what's actually there. And you just let your brain perceive.
Exactly. And you let your imagination run wild. Absolutely. Yeah. We are The Ghouls Next Door, a media literacy show from a horror lens where we explore the real life, historical, and psychological reasonings behind our cinematic fears. And today we're talking about a particularly spooky film. It is, I guess, found footage. It is experimental. It is childlike in wonderment. We're talking Skinamarink from 2022. Yeah, I think Skinamarink is such an interesting film. It went from no to like nothing. Like it wasn't around. And then all of a sudden it was what everyone couldn't stop talking about. And it was kind of leaked and had to go to theaters rather quickly. And I remember it had a short release. And, you know, I ran to go see it with a friend, and I'll talk about like how awesome that experience was. But I had no idea what to expect. But I will say one of the things that we discussed in like our assumption, which we were right, was that we were going to really enjoy this film because we both have an appreciation for found footage and specifically for doing more with like our imagination than just showing us what is scary. I think a lot of the beautiful parts of found footage is like that slow burn where you're just guessing and you're thinking like, what is it? Like literally nothing happens in Paranormal Activity until the last like 10 minutes of the film. And it's still like there's that tension that you're building the entire time. And this film 100% had that throughout the whole thing. But on top of that, it's experimental. So it had that added benefit of like not quite making sense at all and having moments that were scary. But most of the moments you're like, what is going on? I'm so uncomfortable. Something is happening and I can't see it.
Yeah, it just really plays upon the like imagination and the human capacity to fill in the blanks with scary stuff, especially like because it was positioned as a horror movie, that's already your expectation. So like your brain is doing all the work for you and the film is just kind of setting you up as with like the landscape for it. Mm-hmm. So like if you're predispositioned to fear, you're going to love this film because it's going to scare you because your brain's going to be really overactive and like channeling all of like the setup that the film gives you. So like I totally agree. I think like we both have pretty expansive imaginations that are and anxiety to boot. And the combination of both of those things ties up very nicely to make us very much enjoy this film, and similarly to like how we enjoyed Paranormal Activity.
Yeah, I think like the reviews for this film tend to be pretty split, because there are some people who like don't get the hype. And those are people who probably wouldn't have gotten anything out of it regardless of the hype, Like, you have to be a certain kind of person that enjoys this type of media. And if you do, then you're really going to love it, right? It's, you know, suspending disbelief and just kind of allowing yourself to be a child again and be uncertain and be afraid of things that we don't know or understand. And that kind of unlocks this new fear, like this new, or not new, it's like something we haven't felt in a very long time. Right? It's something that's we've kind of put behind us as adults. And so I think anyone who can sit in a film and just let it take you will really enjoy that for sure.
Yeah, I feel like if you're the kind of person who, when you turn off the light and you run up the stairs, you like cackle a little bit because you're terrified that something's chasing you, even though you know that nothing is, you'll like this movie. But if you just like walk up the stairs, like nothing's in the darkness, I'm totally fine. You probably won't like this movie because your imagination isn't in that space. And that's fine.
Yeah. Or if you're somebody like, your friends have to drag you to like a haunted house. And then while you're there, you're like, oh, this isn't scary. This is so dumb. And you just kind of walk and like roll your eyes. You're not going to like this. Yeah. This isn't the kind of, you also probably don't really like horror. You just like gore, which is okay, but that's different.
it's just a different vibe. It's a different vibe. And this vibe is for the people who like just have fun being scared.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. And as I dive into my section, I think something that's also really exciting is that because it's experimental, because it's so bizarre and nonsensical in a lot of ways, people have all kinds of theories. And I'm happy to say that they're all right and they're all wrong. So it's exciting. I love that interpretation. Yeah, that's
super fun. Oh, I'm excited to hear your section. I didn't read it ahead of time, so it's going to be like fresh.
Good. Cool. Well, why don't I hop in? Because I got a lot to say. So much to say. So we're talking about Skinamarink from 2022, and it is about two children wake up in the middle of the night to find their father is missing, and all the windows and doors in their home have vanished. And it's directed by Kyle Edward Ball. So I watch Skinamarink in what I believe to be the best possible way, and I'm so sorry, Kat, I did not watch it with you first.
I know.
But I'm also really glad I didn't pass on it. It was something that it just wasn't ever going to work for you.
Yeah. So you watched it with an honorary ghoul, so it's fine.
Exactly. So what I believe to be the best possible way, which is on a cold, gloomy Monday night in a forgotten theater in New Jersey with one of my best friends who is an avid horror fan, as I explained, both geeking out about, you know, Paranormal Activity. Anyone who actually genuinely appreciates Paranormal Activity, the first one, for what it is, like, they get me. So yeah. We were on top of it being like cold, gloomy Monday night, like it was raining, it was like a little chilly. We were the only ones in the theater, which amplified the horror, but it also allowed us to fully experience the film. And we were able to talk about what we were feeling in the moment and try to make sense of the darkness around us, which if anyone has watched a movie with me, you know, I'm an avid talker in movies. I know it's a curse. I know people hate it, but it is something I do. It's how I just work through things. And so it was nice to be able to almost operate as if I was at home, but in this huge theater. And we were, you know, curled into ourselves, hiding from the intense silence that was mixed with these jarring sounds every now and again. Our interpretation of the world became twisted as rooms turned upside down and plunged us into darkness. And we quickly became concerned for the safety of the two kids on screen, but also for our own safety in the deep, dark theater. Like, I really felt like I was there. And I was like screaming out for the kids, like, don't go up there. like, Kevin, are you okay? I felt so connected to them. And at the same time being like, what is going on? What's happening to us? Because we were there with them essentially abandoned in our own way. You know how dark theaters get, where you like you just see the one glowing exit sign, and that's what we had. So it was an experience. And as a camera,
like, I'm sure like cacophony, like the sounds just had to hit so much harder being in like a big space by yourself.
They're so loud, and they were to the point where at the end of the film, so by the end, I was just so stressed, like I was so tense. For the entire film, you are tense, and there's no reprieve because you constantly don't know what's going on because of the way that the film is shot. You are just wondering what is actually happening, what's happening outside of our vision that we're not allowed to see. And it just amplified. And then there's the crinkling of the static on screen, plus like the sounds that would like come in jarringly loud at random times. Like you can kind of expect when it would happen, but most often it was like abrupt. And so there's just by the end of it, both me and Jeff were sitting like scrunched up in the chairs with our hands over our ears and mine like occasionally over my eyes, where I'd have to watch through my fingers because I was just so like I was just so tense. And so both of us were just like curled up like, oh no, what's happening? And honestly, we left that feeling like that was probably the best way to experience such a film because it was so absurd. And as the camera cut to other views, familiar hallways in the house, we could see them transform from the harmless dark house into a potential home of some unknown, not quite seen monster hiding safely in the dark. And there was a, you know, running gag for me that there was a particular hallway. And every time they went to that hallway, it freaked me out because I was convinced that something was there, even though I'm fairly certain nothing was. But every time it cut to that hallway, I was like, oh, no, it's the hallway again. It's that hallway again. And I know there's something watching me in there. And it's not. That's not how films work.
And like at varying angles and zooms, too, which just like added so much to that fear, because it's like you have that graininess and you're just experiencing that like scary shifting darkness. It like didn't feel still, so like I totally agree with you that it felt like something was like in that hallway even if there wasn't.
They were very clever about the static, because it does make your eyes kind of see things that weren't there. You know, when you stare at like a bright thing and then you look away, you still see like the imprint of it. It's like that. Plus you know, sometimes they would just be clever with the shadows so that it looked like a person there, or they would cut into, like they just like cut in deeper into the darkness and you're like, why are you doing that? This is so good. It's stupid good. So having rewatched the film at home with Kat midday, I could say with certainty that there was a magic present in my first watch that I lacked in my second. And I do really worry that it may have affected your interpretation or even the severity of the film, Kat. So I apologize that we weren't submerged in complete darkness, but we were alone. And I was, you know, there to scold you into watching, so you could feel a little scared. So
I think the fear was still there because we were we watched it midday, but it like got dark by the end of it. And then we were like just sitting alone in the house and we're like, all right, well now I'm scared to go upstairs. And like stuff like that. So like it still did hit for me. It's probably just like not as hard as it did when you watched it in the theater. But I will say I was still pretty scared.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah. I was worried. I was like, I hope I didn't ruin this for you. Because I'm really glad that Skin and Rink got a theatrical release, though it was short, like a short run. And I do recommend that folks see it in any way that they can. And if you are watching it on Shudder somewhere at home, do it with friends in a darkened space with the sound turned up too high to get the full experience. Yeah. just plunge yourself into the darkness and let it ruin when you go home and have to go to the bathroom at night. And you're like, has my hallway always been this sinister? I don't know. I don't remember. I don't remember there being ghosts back there, but I guess there are. Yeah. So let me tell you what Skin and Rink is about. And then I'm going to dive into some of the theories because it is an experimental film and a lot of people have interpretations. I will say some, like, I watched it the first time without any interpretation. I didn't know anything besides the walls, the doors and windows disappear, and there's two kids. Yeah. I had heard brief ideas, but I had no idea. And so when I went in, it was really stressful because I had no idea what was going on. I do think that in my second watch, having looked into what was going on, it helped inform some of the decisions and scenes that I was seeing that helped me appreciate it even more. So, you know, there are spoilers when I get to the hypotheses of people, their, you know, thesis of what the film might be about. And it's totally up to you, but you can absolutely skip that part. Or it might actually help with you appreciating the film from that lens, or at least getting over the incredibly experimental view. Like, if you need a thread, like if you need a plot, then let me give you one, because there isn't one straight up.
Otherwise, yeah.
Yeah. So Skinamarink is a bizarre and disquieting film about interpreting the darkness with a young mind, following two siblings, Kevin, who is 4 years old, and Kaylee, who is 6 years old. These are babies. As they discover their father missing, the doors and windows removed, and themselves ultimately alone in the darkness. And the film is experimental with strange angles, focusing the camera on areas we don't often linger on in film or life. And because of these shots, focus on the corners above or below our standard vision, viewers are always left with only interpretations of the world around us. The film cycles through these stagnant shots, bringing us to different areas of the house, and sometimes with no rhyme or reason, and often against our will. Like that dang hallway. Every time we came back, I was like, stop, don't make me do it.
I don't want to be here.
Or it's like, what's really, so this is something that people talk about often, it's these shots that are just like the corner of the room, and it's the ceiling. And I would say, like, if it were specifically from the point of view of children, I think we'd have a lot more, like, low shots. It's just supposed to be these weird, jarring angles that make you uncomfortable because it's not the way we perceive the world. And because you're being cheated, you don't get to see what's in this room. You only get to see that corner. So you have to wonder what's in the rest of this room, because that corner is really scary. So it's like, what else is
your
there?
Your brain does the work, I'm telling you.
It's so good. Yeah, I can't wait to hear your section, Kat. So the story starts with Kevin wandering the halls after bedtime, and we never see Kevin's face or Kaylee's or anyone's. We only catch glimpses of their feet or the back of their head. At one point, we do see Kaylee's face, but we don't see Kaylee's face. I will explain.
Yeah.
But at this point, Kevin sits in the hallway looking up to someone or something before going to his sister's room to ask to play. We hear a child counting as if playing hide and seek before a fall leads to a wailing cry. And we can interpret that Kevin is then taken to the hospital while Kaylee waits at home. And upon their return, their father is heard on the phone with presumably their mother and informs them that Kevin had a fall, but is okay, not even needing stitches. After this, the kids wake to find their father is gone. It's still dark. And as they wander the house, trying to figure out what to do next, they notice the doors and windows zap out of existence and they're replaced with a wall. Yeah. It's a weird, like, child's... like approach to something that's honestly terrifying for me. With, because it makes us like wall 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 think, and then it's like gone. So it's and that's like a repetitious sound that we hear that can be linked back to the cartoons, which I'll explain. There's some cartoons that mirror what's happening to the kids in the film, but these sound effects are very reminiscent of the cartoons that they're listening to, very reminiscent of just like childlike sounds matched up with something that is absolutely terrifying, which I didn't write this in the script, but just as like one of the more horrifying things that I thought of when I was watching this film was there was this one time when, so I shared a room with my older sister, and she had, her favorite color is lime green. So we had, our room was painted lime green, which at night, like if the moon was, you know, coming in, looked pretty white. Like it was just fully white. like scared.
Yeah.
And I woke up in the middle of the night and I had to pee. And so I like got down from my bunk bed and I was trying to go to the bathroom and the door just wasn't there. Like our bedroom door was just gone. Like I'm feeling That's around crazy. For it and it's gone. Like I felt around the whole room and it's just blank wall. It's just white wall everywhere. And I was like, I know the door should be over here. So terrified. I was like 9 and then I like climb back up onto my bed and I'm just like, I'm just gonna go to sleep and hopefully the door is there when I wake up. And it was, and it's never happened again, but it was like something that has stuck in my brain for forever. So when those doors started to disappear, it brought me right back to that very specific moment of just being like, okay, we're just gonna go to sleep and the world's the glitch in the matrix yeah. will fix itself. Because somehow I got trapped That's in so here funny. And I need to get
yeah.
out.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. nightmares of kids. It's like so real. that sounds so scary, Gabe. I'm sorry you experienced that. It's okay. I hope you never experienced that in adulthood.
I think it would be worse if it was in adulthood. Because I don't know if my reaction would be to go to sleep. My reaction would probably you're be probably like, trying I'm to break trapped out. Forever and I will die. So,
yeah, fair enough.
I hope for the sake of my house that I'm not trapped in it at any point. So, at this point, the kids see the walls and they're instead of doors and instead of windows. And it's funny because you could see that there had been a window there because there's the shade, like the window shade, but then you look behind it and there's no window. So what happened? And the kids are just like, what was that? Like they're always whispering and there's only sometimes subtitles when we were in the theater, which was really aggravating. So I was thankful that watching it at home, I could have subtitles all the time, which means I got to understand some more things. A big advocate for subtitles always.
Yeah.
Even in theaters. So the windows zap out of existence. There's a wall now. And then the phone is also disconnected, they find, leaving them truly alone in the home. Because they're, like I said, their father's missing. The wall, the doors are missing. The phone does not connect them to the outside world. So they make camp in their living room with only toys, snacks, a TV playing old cartoons, and each other for company. Because that's a kid's coping mechanism. Like, they're like, can we sleep down here? Yeah, 100% we're gonna be together. So as the film progresses, the kids start to hear a strange voice that begins making requests of them in the darkness. It tells them to go upstairs, to go downstairs, to play with it, and even hurt themselves. And something is there in the darkness stealing their toys, and eventually even Kaylee's face. I did mention that we see Kaylee's face, quotation marks, because we don't see Kaylee's face. This thing steals it. So viewers are left to interpret not only the story, but what we're seeing just flat out. The answer seemed to be just out of view, if only we could fix the camera. And just outside of our periphery, is the darkness moving? Is there a face in that shadow? Is this voice real? What is happening to poor Kaylee and Kevin? Where is their dad? What happened to their mom? What does the 572 days text at the end mean? What is any of this?
Yeah.
You are going to wonder. The beauty of films, especially something as experimental as Skinamarink, is that the answers are whatever you want them to be. Because in the end, Skinamarink, enforcing you to stare into the darkness, to be shrouded in the disquiet and jarring alarming noises, to drown in the VHS static on the screen, reduces us back to a childlike understanding of the world. It unlocks a horror unique to young brains, left to interpret the shadows as something potentially monstrous. Like, I don't know what that is, but it's probably something scary. And when the film finished in the theater, we were frozen in our seats. The credits were in the beginning, so there's no real indication that the film was over, except for the absence of that VHS static. And after we left, Jeff and I both experienced a new relationship with the dark. And Kat, you also had that relationship after we watched it.
Yeah.
The hallways and rooms of our own homes that we're familiar with had transformed into new, uncertain, and terrifying spaces. We pondered if the hallway had always been this dark, this ominous, and full of potential terror. Like, I took pictures. I took a picture of my hallway. I was like, is it always this scary?
Yeah.
And I felt at once returned to a youthful consciousness of the world and of the moving shadows around us. I became aware of how I'd grown into either dismissing or simply not acknowledging darkness in my adulthood. It made me respect darkness in a new way.
Respect like, oh, out of fear. Yes.
Exactly. And the potential. Like, I think the same way with, like, an incessant noise, we can often, if it's droning, we can drown it out, right? Our brain can, like, decide that's not important. And so we can have the power to not focus on it. Some of us who have misophobia might hyper focus on it. or yeah. More spicy folks. But oftentimes our brain does do some good work in drowning out some of those exterior noises or just like unnecessary information.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's what the dark is for us as adults, is that we've drowned out the potential of fear. And because it's like, well, we don't need that. But yeah. We do need it. So.
Or you never did and you've always been scared of the dark.
Yeah. Which is me. Totally valid. You could be afraid of the dark. There's potential in there.
That's why lights out is my literal nightmare. Continue.
Oh, such a good short. So I'm going to get into some of the interpretations and theories that fans have of the film. I will say there are going to be spoilers in this section because to explain why people think what they think and some of the scarier things, they're going to do that. So feel free to skip ahead to Kat's section instead of getting spoiled here. Or like I said, it might help to give yourself some kind of motivation for what is happening in the story to fully immerse yourself in it and not be like,
yeah,
like angry that you don't know what's happening. Or you might also be someone who really, really digs that. I will say there's no real like twist or anything. It's just an experience. And I think you get that regardless of what you know to be true, because none of this is true and all of it is true. So because of the experimental nature of this film, there's no one explanation for what is occurring on screen, and the story is something viewers piece together for themselves. Director Kyle Edward Ball has not explained his own motives outside of confirming that everyone is right and wrong in their interpretation, saying, first of all, every fan theory is true, and every fan theory is false. Someone had a theory that I'm the monster, and then someone had a whole theory based around the dollhouse that appears in the movie, that they're all in the dollhouse. That's so neat, right?
That's fun.
Like, it is neat. There's also like different names for the monster. There's like the voice in the dark, the monster, the Skinamarink, Kyle Edward Ball, whatever it is. So
yeah.
If you, like me, were scrambling for some meaning behind the film to help shape what you'd seen into something understandable, then here are some of the popular theories by fans online. And remember, these theories are all true and false. So feel free to find which story works best for your own reasoning. So let's dive in to those spoilers. So one of the first ones I see pretty popular, people kind of lean into this, and it was one of the first ones I saw when I was trying to figure out what the heck was going on. So it is one that people do enjoy. And this is a theory that stems from the opening scenes containing some of the only dialogue in the film. It's a very, very few dialogue scenes. So after Kevin had fallen and hurt himself, resulting in a quick hospital run, Kevin's father tells someone on the phone that Kevin is fine. The theory people have come up with is that Kevin's fall was very much not all right, and instead Kevin's fall caused severe damage to his brain, and he is now in a coma. In an article on Signal Horizon titled Skinamarink Explained, Child Abuse, Death, and the Monsters of Our Youth, writer Tracy Palmer explains, Kevin did fall down the stairs, but he is likely not okay. The poor child is almost certainly severely injured, and everything that happens from that point forward is the imagined nightmare of a damaged mind. And further, Palmer connects Ball's previous film, Heck, to this one as its spiritual successor, saying, one of Ball's previous shorts, Heck, from which this movie was based, deals with the same subject matter, although in a slightly different manner. Everything from feeling trapped to the number of days displayed at the bottom of the screen late in the movie is an indication that the boy is in a coma and has been for over a year. I did mention there being 572 days. That's what I mean. So I will explain that. So the events that unfold after this call, the disappearing doors and windows, the voice in the dark, and some of the truly haunting scenes of discussions between Kaylee and her parents are explained as Kevin's interpretation from his coma. So he is trapped, much like he is in the film, unable to control his own body and forced to obey an unknown voice. The conversations he hears are of his loved ones, just out of reach, and he is only receiving pieces of those conversations. The repetitive cartoons on the TV could be what the family has left on for him while he is under, hoping to offer some comfort in this dark mental space. And the idea is that the text, so at the film, the only text we see on screen after like a torrent of just unsettling imagery is, it says 572 days with like no context. Nothing else happens. And you're like, what does that mean? The theory is that it is telling us how many days Kevin has been in a coma. And at the end of the film, the voice in the dark tells Kevin to sleep. It says, go to sleep. And this is perhaps asking Kevin to finally let go and move on. So that's one theory. The next theory is also incredibly popular with people online and was one that I, when I was watching with Kat, it's the one that I was leaning towards. And so it did inform some of my interpretations that second watch, because I was kind of looking for where this was, because it does, it kind of makes sense to me, but then it also doesn't. So after I explain what it is, I'll explain why it sort of doesn't. So another theory from viewers is even darker than Kevin's coma. Based on the absence of their mother and a vehemence from Kaylee against even talking about her, it's clear something scary has occurred between the children and their mother. The parents are clearly separated, and when thinking of the phone call between their father and the person on the phone, presumed to be their mom, that he is letting them know as a courtesy. It definitely felt like, at the very least, these are two people who are separated. You know, like, oh, don't freak out. He start like he starts the call saying that. And there's a hesitance in his voice, an uncertainty as to what he will be met with when sharing this bad news. And he's working very hard to downplay what is happening. So even if he isn't actually hurt, he's working really hard to drive that home before. Like, it's all good. Everything's fine. We're okay. I'm just telling you because it's the right thing to do to tell you. When the house first begins to change and the children are alarmed, they call out for their father, not their mother, which a lot of people thought was bizarre. And I get it. I mean, it seemed like they were pretty close to their dad, but it is like an expectation that kids in horror movies would call for their mom. So it's like, that's one of the first weird things. But this also could just be because they are staying at their father's house. But there's this lack of love for mom, and it's seen again when Kevin mentions their mom, guessing that perhaps dad went where mom is. And Kaylee responds rather sharply, I don't want to talk about mom. She's very aggressive about it. And clearly it's a soft spot. And whenever we see mom or a mom-like person in the house, it's not a good time. It's not a good, it's not a comfort to see mom. So for a child, abuse is often seen as something inescapable and silencing, and this could be expressed through the absence of the doors and windows and later by the removal of Kaylee's mouth. The phone is disconnected because they literally cannot call for help. They're not allowed. In an article on Screen Rant titled Skinamarink's Mysterious Voice Could Be Darker Than You Realize, writer Kevin Mikos hypothesizes, Skinamarink doesn't give the audience many answers, but one interpretation of the mysterious voice is that it is a representative of the missing parents. The voice acts in a way that emulates abusive parents and may well serve as a stand-in for the missing parents. The kids are told what to do, and if they don't do it, they are harmed. The most horrific example of the abuse is when the voice tells Kevin to stab himself in the eye, followed by a shot of blood appearing on a wall. The voice ensures the children that if they disobey, harm will be done to them anyway, such as an abusive parent might. So there's definitely like a control from this voice. Later in one of the more unsettling scenes, Kaylee finds herself upstairs at the request of the voice in the dark. She enters her parents' room and sees what appears to be her father sitting on the bed. He asks her to look under the bed, and she does. It's a tense scene of uncertainty where you're screaming at the screen for her not to look under the bed, because you're like, what is under the bed? Don't look under the bed. Don't listen to them. Because you're not knowing what we're going to see under there or on the bed when she comes back up. And after she looks, nothing is there. And then she's told to look again, and still she sees nothing. When she sits back up, her father is gone, but now her mother is sitting on the other side of the bed. And her mother has a disorienting and stuttering conversation with her that sounds reminiscent of a talk you'd have with your kids if you and your partner were separating, which is the start of the discomfort. It's certainly not the end of the scene, but it's very much like, your dad and I love you very much, you know?
Yeah. Like, this so is it's your kind of, fault. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, this could be a part of the coma conversation. Like, perhaps Kaylee and the mom are having this conversation in the room to explain, like, maybe Kaylee feels guilty for having played with Kevin, right? Although she does say Kevin was playing by himself. He was sleepwalking, she says. There's also just a lot of discomfort around the mom and her presence in the film. And so YouTuber Wendigoon has a great analysis video about it titled Skinamarink, A Forgotten Nightmare that Kat and I had watched, about the relationship between the mother and the kids, as well as how she remains a haunting villainous form in the film, luring the children to harm. And Wendigoon explains that the mother may have been sick and died. And that same scene of the mother in the bedroom, the mom tells Kaylee not to look. Like, she, like, disappears, and she's in, like, the closet. And she tells her not to look, and you're like, don't look, Kaylee. And of course she does. Looking.
Yeah.
And we hear this awful sound of, like, bones crunching and groans from the mother in the closet being clearly in pain. And as we linger on the darkened doorway, a hand grasps out of the darkness. It is gnarled and unwell. Later, we see a figure much like the mother in areas of the house, only seeing the back of her head, and at some point, she slowly fades into the background before things truly begin to spiral. It also could be argued that it's her voice that's beckoning them to do things, because you'd be more inclined to do it if your mother told you than if a scary voice in the dark did.
Yeah.
There's also the idea that she wasn't sick, but that she actually unalived herself. And evidence of this has been mentioned online on Reddit. A user pointed out a shot of a doll hanging from the ceiling, and later that the unsettling crunching noises they described are similar to the sound of a neck snapping. And this would insinuate that the mom had hung herself. She is most definitely gone, I think, given the Kevin's comments about how dad went with mom. It's clearly she's not here, but perhaps she took her own life and their father is dealing with that grief. This could mean the father isn't gone at all, but instead is the very monster tormenting the children in his own inability to cope with the loss of her. So it could be that he's not physically gone, but emotionally he's gone, and he has been transformed by his grief into something unrecognizizable. It's also possible that it's the father who is the abuser after all. The mom is gone and could possibly have been gone at the hands of their father, whether by murder or divorce. So mom is gone and it's dad's fault. And children often see adults, especially parents, as being a stronger force unlike themselves, perhaps even a monstrous force that is controlling their lives, sometimes like gods or superheroes, supervillains. Like, not being held to the same limits that they see in themselves. So, in the later half of the film, the voice in the dark tells Kevin that it took Kaylee's mouth when she was asking for her parents and wasn't doing as she was told. And the taking of her mouth could quite literally be silencing her through action so that she can't speak up about the abuse. And it's also telling them what to do the entire time. So, that's a big part of it, too. There's also these are two last theories that people have. I am not fans of them. I don't think they hit as hard as the other ones. They're kind of lazy. And if they are the answer, it's like lazy writing. But there is the idea that perhaps this unfortunate family have found themselves in a Lost situation. Lost being the television show about the plane crash that everyone predicted was about purgatory or limbo, only for the showrunners to agree, but also disagree and make a really complicated, sloppy ending. Like, just own it. I hate it when shows just don't own it. Like, I, if
yeah.
the people like guessed Game of Thrones, it, that's
they did
fine.
The same thing. Like, let them guess it. It's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, that just means you did a good job of placing all the hints. Like, I'll still yeah. be, I'll feel good instead of, like, give me something weird. Anyway, so some viewers hypothesize that the entire family, or theorize that the entire family is actually dead and the children are the last to navigate this limbo to find their ultimate end, spending 571 days in the in-between before their fate is decided, suspended in a not-quite-comforting good place to subdue them during the decision-making. So it's, like, kind of a weird middle ground for children to be okay, because it's your house, but you can't leave yeah. it, and you have, like, your toys, but they're slowly leaving you because now we're making the decision.
Yeah.
So... then this other one, the villain all along is the unassuming child. The theory from certain Reddit users is that Kevin, this four-year-old baby, has multiple personalities and has killed his whole family. That's just, if you dig into the archives of Ghouls episodes, I don't even know if that episode still exists, but you might find an episode about children and how incredibly unlikely it is that they do murder, and certainly not in such a sinister fashion. They're not, yeah. they don't have it. in them to really understand that, and I yeah. don't.
Like, four. If it was to happen, it's because they don't understand the permanence, or, like, they think it's a game and don't realize that it's real, but it's still super unlikely.
Yeah. And for all of them, like, it just, that doesn't, and he's four. Like, what can yeah, he do?
He's a baby.
What can
baby.
His hands do? He can only hold the big crayons. Yeah. Like, he can't, he has no dexterity.
He can barely carry juice. Like,
yeah, he can't even get his own juice. I got you juice. Yeah. So whichever of the explanations you find helps you through the film, they're correct, because Kyle yeah. Edward Ball succeeds when you leave the theater, or however you're viewing the film, reduced to a child afraid of what's right outside of your vision, lingering in the darkness and waiting to pounce. Having experienced that youthful appreciation and terror of the dark, I highly enjoyed the film. Ball explains this connection to a simplistic fear in the film, saying, "I think it's hard not to identify so deeply with the story because we've all been little kids at some point and we've all been afraid." I think it's a stretch to say story, but in that way, yes. it is a unifying story with any number of endings and explanations, having us jump at the soft sounds we muted and creating figures where there had not been before.
Yeah,
so that's my little take.
Yeah, it achieves that. I feel like, honestly, I would have believed any of them. It does a really good job just, like, being surprising, you know what I mean? Like, just being spooky and, like, really just allow. Sometimes I don't like that, like, when they're like, oh, it could have been anything, and you're like, okay, but, like, what was it? But in this instance, I accept that as the answer, because, like, yeah, like, I need you to tell me, it haunts me. But, like, this was not one of those instances. I thought it was actually, because there was so little plot in terms of, like, clear explanations, it was fun to have that kind of ambiguity, where there's plenty of films where I don't feel that way, but this one, success. And it was super scary. And I will say, like, as an adult who actually is scared of the dark, like, I have been sitting here this entire time lightly freaked out by, like, the darkness around me, and especially your background, Gabe. Like, there's a little white thing in the center of your bookcase, and I don't know what it is, and I hate it. I hate it because it feels like it's moving. It's so scary. I thought it was Charlie, and I was like, what is that? It's so scary. So, like, I am very scared of the dark. When I turn off the light, I, like, rapidly run to my door. When Isaiah was in London, I left the bathroom light on in the hallway the entire time. Like, I would not go to bed in total darkness, because no, absolutely not. I have a very active imagination. I spent the bulk of my childhood playing by myself, so my brain works extra hard.
Yeah.
And filling the darkness with things, and that has extended into my adult life. Once you get, like, positioned with the understanding that, like, monstrous things could exist, your brain will naturally go there. And I think it just really plays upon that. And I'm going to get into exactly, like, why it was so scary for kids and, like, why that was so effective. So, you know, let me do it. The film covers heavy themes in an abstract way, focusing on the young mind and how they perceive the world around them. Children themselves and their development perceive the world much differently than adults, and the world of a young mind is overwhelming and vast and hard to understand. As what is perceived visually, auditorily, and others through other sensory inputs is entirely dependent on your brain's best guess to fill in the blank and rationalize our surroundings. That's how the brain processes information. What you're looking at isn't even what you're looking at. You know, it's just your brain trying to rationalize what it's seeing. And the more context you have, the more accurate it's going to be. That's why they really highlight cognitive processing and development in as you grow. But children don't have all the information. Adult brains have been around longer, so they have more context to pull for them, where children view the world without that context. So the fear and anxiety that children experience may seem silly to an adult viewing them, but is something very real for the child. And what we see in the film is seemingly a child's first time entirely alone in the house, although they are with a sibling, under the dark of night. And as we've covered in our early Nightmares episode, the brain has a tendency to manipulate darkness and silence to fit the things we understand and know. So in presenting us with endless clips of that dark hallway and with like very little audio cues, like without the subtitles and without like a clear image of what's happening, your brain is tasked with filling in that blank space, interpreting all those background sounds, interpreting that grainy image that's in front of you. And what was really creative in him taking that approach to filming is that he made his job a lot easier by doing that, because of the way that the brain works, in that it will fill in those blanks. And in manipulating that darkness and silence, the film uses this and runs with it by placing all of that like right in the purview and giving you really little other context. So it's kind of like when you're sitting in your bed at night and your brain has nothing else to grasp for, you know, you have like silence when you're like trying to go to bed, mm-hmm. and all the rest of the world is slowed down. And then your brain creates space within that. So like, that's when your anxiety kicks in. That's when you're like, oh, let me remember every horrible thing that's ever happened to me as I lay here in bed, or other things, you know,
the guy in the hat who torments me in my sleep paralysis.
Yeah, exactly. Like your brain will fill in that space because of the lack of outside input that's taking place. So this film, just in knowing we're watching a horror movie, sets itself up to be scary the entire time, to make you tense the entire time. Mm-hmm. So similarly, children's minds, absent of the context of lived experience, apply this method of perception to basically everything and base it mostly on emotional cues as well as the cues of the parental figures in their lives. The greater gap in understanding and contextual data, the scarier an experience can become for a child. When taking situations that are overwhelming sensory-wise, children will fill these spaces with things they do not have the understanding for yet or around, and therefore will start to see things that would otherwise feel mundane to adults, but will perceive it as horrifying. Mm-hmm. So, especially with the absence of a parental or peer sounding board, being alone for a small child can be very scary when all their needs are not able to be self-managed. So we see like these two kids basically having to deal with the absence of their parent without being of an age where they have the capabilities to take care of themselves. Mm-hmm. Like they don't have methods to feed themselves. They don't cook, you know, they're like little kids. They really rely on their parents ultimately, and the absence of them is terrifying for a multitude of reasons, but it's very evident for a child that the absence of their parent could lead to their harm, could lead to their damage or even the loss of life. So this is why neglect is so mentally and physically damaging for small children, as the absence of a protective figure always has that possibility of resulting in loss of life. And the film itself plays upon this further by taking a house and morphing it into a horrific and endlessly expanding maze
mostly absent of this parent figure. The voice of a stranger, although positioned as an adult authority figure, is terrifying and threatening to the children of the film. And what's interesting about this is that actually, like, in terms of brain development, children do perceive, if they've spent the majority of their life like around their parents and are not used to strangers, strangers can seem very scary. Or even thinking of the abuse angle with like an adult, like kids are told you have to listen to adults, even if that adult could be telling you to do something harmful. It is a child's natural inclination to listen to an adult authority figure if that has been instilled in them as something that they should do. So yeah, this authority figure is very terrifying and threatening to the children in the film, and the fear surrounding this darkness and things that are outside of the standard perception are common with both children and adults, but the differences around the understanding of the perceived versus real threats is what really makes it more scary for kids. An adult may fear the dark, but rationalize that fear is only like a perceived threat. It's not real. It's not, nothing's going to actually hurt me in this darkness. But a child is not going to be able to talk themselves out of that. They will perceive, they won't be able to tell the difference between a perceived threat and a very real and visceral one. So understanding, like, an adult is like, all right, if I turn the hall light off and walk to my room, nothing bad's going to happen to me in the middle unless I trip, you know. But a kid might feel very viscerally that something is chasing them, even if that's not happening. Any kind of sound can really activate that terror that they feel. And essentially a child just has a harder time telling the difference between the two as their minds have less time to cognitively develop. So Crystal Lewis, a clinical psychologist and researcher at the National Institute of Mental Health, noted that people may experience fears of the dark very commonly, but this is due to things that they see or hear about, thoughts in their head, or bad things they may have experienced. So the darkness can also manifest their trauma as well. So if this was a movie about abuse, the fact that the abuse like scenarios would perpetuate in this dark house makes sense. She also said some people have a biological predisposition to the fear and anxiety, which can manifest at night due to generational trauma, which I just found objectively interesting. That like your generational existence could influence your specific fears around like just existing at night.
Well, I mean, it's the, if you think about just like evolution,
right?
Like where we develop to fear things for our safety, and if like historically in like your ancestor history that thing has been scary, I can see that holding on through the genes to
help
you feel safe.
So exactly. And like, so in many ways, these fears don't have to be something that is externally motivated. Ultimately, children basically can have just like a natural inclination towards this fear because of generational trauma as the cause. So you could have a child who's having night terrors, not because they're traumatized, but like in that stage of existence, but literally just because there's generational trauma that's influencing those fears. And kind of like influencing their imaginations because of it being genetic. It's a biological predisposition. So super interesting. And as children are inclined to fill that empty space with their imaginations, this capacity for the fear, if it is instinctual, can be even more stressful. And what occupies their imagination are filled with the context given, as I said, by their parents, things they see, but as well as instinct. So what they fear additionally is usually, but not exclusively, influenced by what they witness and see. And that's evidenced in this article that I read on Better Health Channel titled Anxiety and Fear in Children. And they unpack the way fear impacts children at different developmental stages. So yeah, I'm going to go through this kind of like year by year. So it kind of goes through, this article goes through like, one, the things that influence fear and anxiety within children. So it can be that you have genetic susceptibility, which I mentioned before, or the representation of like mental health issues in the parent that they're interacting with. So if they have an anxious parent, children learn how to behave by watching their parents. So if they have a parent that's very stressed out all the time or very anxious about what's around them, those fears will transfer to the child. This also accounts for overprotective parenting. So if a dependent child is more likely to feel helpless, this can lead to generalized anxiety because like they're used to their parent protecting them. And when that parent is not there, that really just like adds to the separation anxiety associated with that. And obviously like stressful events such as trauma, such as parental separation, an injury, or hospital stay can exacerbate these fears and make them worse. So they kind of go through this at each developmental stage. I also read a few articles that were talking about like the prenatal, like while you're still in your stomach, the ways that your brain develops and how that can like influence your fears. But I'm really going to focus like postnatal, like they are out into the world.
Yeah.
Just because like that seems like it relates more to the film itself and that we're just not getting into like fun science theories. So once a baby has reached 6 to 7 months of age, they have formed strong attachments to their parents or caregivers. Separation from their special people, even for short periods of time, can cause considerable anxiety, plenty of crying, and just like a general feeling of like unsafeness. Similarly, many babies prefer the exclusive company of their special people so much that they develop fear of strangers for a period of time. It is said that babies will grow out of this, but it is something that takes place where the face of another person could be genuinely scary for a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And they give some suggestions on ways to help the child cope with this. So if you are a new parent and you're dealing with a 6 to 7 month old child who's experiencing a lot of fear or anxiety, they do list some steps and things that you can do to kind of help babies cope with that separation anxiety as well as this fear of strangers. So it basically just says like communicate with your baby. Like if you're in the room, announce you're there, announce when you're leaving, communicate like when you're going away so that they can develop trust for you. And basically like let your baby get to know other people. And that's hard, especially in a pandemic society. Mm-hmm. Because now we've been retrained to not let people near, because babies are immunocompromised. So I feel like we're actually going to probably have a decent amount of babies who are very strong with the stranger danger fear.
Mm-hmm.
Because there hasn't been a lot of socialization outside of like the family group. And they say if your baby is anxious, a good thing to do is to reassure them with like a calm and confident expression, especially in that 6 to 7 month stage. They're looking at your face primarily. I read like a very long article about this where like how babies' eyes develop in terms of like what they are seeing most is that in their very early stages, they're mostly used to seeing faces. Mm-hmm. Very close up to them. So like their perception is mostly facial driven. So like you making a confident expression while it reassuring them is actually the best way to calm them down instead of like, say you're standing far away and doing the exact same thing, because them being able to see a clear image of your face, seeing that you feel calm and confident, will reassure them into believing the same thing. And they actually say, this is something we talked about in previous episodes, but that leaving your baby to cry it out is actually the worst thing you can do. Self-soothing does not exist. Your baby is literally able to die at any moment when they're like, that's their perception of life when they're little. So do not leave them to cry it out, because that'll just make their anxiety worse.
It's also like people who are like, oh, just let them cry it out or whatever. It's like, are you calling my baby a liar?
Yeah,
like you're saying, no, they don't exactly actually need something, because they absolutely do.
Yeah, because like they are babies. They do not have the ability to survive on their own, so they do need you. If they're crying, it is for a reason. If they feel like they need to see you, that's a valid reason. You know, they might miss you. It's okay to go help your baby when they cry, because honestly, if you don't, their anxiety will get worse. Their fears will get worse, because they'll become aware at a very early age that they don't have backup. They don't have that support that they need. And it'll just exacerbate those symptoms, essentially. It goes on to discuss like the common fears for toddlers, specifically children aged around 2 to 3 years old. So now we're getting closer to like Kevin's age range. Mm-hmm. So they're just learning how to like cope with strong feelings such as anger. And a common fear for a toddler is that they will be overwhelmed by powerful emotions. So like they're just experiencing like what it is to like feel things and not understand why. So this is like the most important time to give them the context that they lack. Specifically when I was talking about like their cognitive development, half of their anxiety and fear is that there's just so much of the world that they have to take in that like they don't have any context for rationalizing their reality. So their imagination is going to fill it with like kind of nonsensical and scary things. This is why like there's that like come into your body moment when your memory starts to solidify because before then it's just chaos. All you're seeing is like detached and like kind of scary images of like items and hands that don't really have context. Sounds sound way scarier. Your just cognitive processing is super different because it's has so little context to work with. So as I said, toddlers have a limited understanding of size and very likely will develop seemingly irrational fears because they don't really have a perception of space or like what is possible versus not possible. So like a big thing that they say is like, don't dismiss your child's fears because to them it is real. Mm-hmm. So like, even though it seems like silly or irrational to you that they think they might fall down the hole in the toilet, to them, that's like visceral and like terrifying because they don't know that that like can't happen, you know? Mm-hmm. So they say suggestions to help your toddler are basically like talking to them about their fears and anxieties. Like communication is a big piece of it. Like being open and communicative with your baby to let them know everything is okay. And like appreciate that it's genuine for them. So like don't belittle them or tell them like face their fears because it actually doesn't help. It actually like furthers the anxiety unless you're like really talking them through it. It's essentially just going to like further validate the fear, or even just like it will become a phobia where it's not even based on anything rational. Just is like an inherent and overwhelming emotion because the toddler at that age is just so susceptible to their emotions. And then essentially like understanding that this can be so visceral. Like I know like when I was little, I had so many fears and they would feel like life and death. Like I would be very convinced that like, I remember one time my mom jokingly said that like, she was gonna like leave me somewhere. And I thought she was so serious that I started hysterically crying and she had to like talk me down. So it's like, you really just have to like accept that like your child is in a space where their emotions are a lot. And they're not ready to hear jokes and that you should not joke about their emotional things. Like it is reality for them. So yeah, it's just like them learning and perceiving the world. And that like a lot of their things and their fears stem from like very real fears that could result in their harm. And that like things like fear of the dark will evolve eventually into like more realistic fears, like fear of burglary, fear of wolves in the woods. You know what I mean? Like things that like could actually harm them in real life. It's all motivated from a real and rational space. It's just maybe not contextualized in a way that seems rational. So as they kind of keep going, we see that like ways that you can kind of help them is just like encouraging them that they're safe and that like they're going to be okay. And that this like fear of the dark is something that's probably going to be around for a while. So like they also say like in another article that I read that like you're not supposed to be like using that fear against them. Like that's actually super manipulative and harmful. Like do your homework or the boogeyman's gonna get you. Like that's like messed up. You don't say that to your baby because the baby believes the boogeyman exists and like is actually going to come for them. And your reinforcement of the fear is kind of like how like if they believe in Santa and you tell them Santa's real, they're gonna believe you. If you reinforce that the boogeyman is real, that fear is only gonna solidify further until they have the greater context to like rationalize that it's not real. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like when they realize the truth about Santa, it's gonna be like similar and like it's gonna take them a while to get there, and you're reinforcing this fear that is going to be genuinely terrifying for them, release cortisol, which is inherently damaging to the developing body. So at the end of the day, this film like does like a really amazing job playing upon all those very real and visceral fears, specifially like that, like the child perspective of things around them, how it feels ginormous, you know, like the hallway that never ends. Mm-hmm. If you feel like your perception of what is around you is that vast, as it really does to a baby, it's going to be really hard to navigate that. And I think what we see with Kaylee is like the parentification of a really young child and her having to like care for her brother in a situation where she is still very much way too young to be taking care of even herself. You kind of see like the loss of self too. So like in the absence of her face is that she is no longer gets to be a kid. She no longer gets to be herself. She has to be this figure for Kevin to protect him, and in doing so is neglecting herself and her own safety, is my interpretation. But yeah, so it's just basically, if you are interested in learning about like the fear of the dark and the way that that is gonna, if you're gonna have kids or if you have kids, impact your babies, the article does go on to like really get into specifically the fear of darkness, and how that develops as the child gets older. But like the biggest thing that they say is like, don't tell them they're wrong, ask them to explain what they're feeling and like really communicate with them so that like that fear feels less overwhelming, and like in doing that, in brain development in general, you're really going to give your child the ability to like communicate their needs as they get older, and it'll just make them better communicators in life. It'll help them stay out of situations that would be otherwise abusive because they advocate for themselves and have the ability to like communicate their needs. So ultimately it is a good thing. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you, Kat, for the little note about Kaylee having to grow too fast. Cause that's super true. Like her, she's the one who has that conversation with the parent figure.
Mm-hmm. And like that's her having to like protect him, you know, from the reality of all the stress that they're going through.
Yeah. And so it is that's super valid, and I'm glad you brought that up because it wasn't in my section. I agree that we should believe babies when they're scared.
Yeah.
And protect them. Like, you know, we're advocates for, you know, scaring your kids, but it's with that idea of like consent, right? Mm-hmm. They're watching something that's like excessively scary, like for kids, with that in mind. Like, you're not subjecting your kids to some form of torture to toughen them up. It's more just like to kind of give them that thrill and an understanding of the world, but always from a safe space, so that they, like, the ultimate part of scaring your kids and our theories for that is that they learn that you're safe and that they're safe, and that no matter what is happening on the screen, like, they can have that within them. They can find a safety, they can find a strength in that. And that's not mm-hmm. the case if you're just like outright just trying to spook them so you can get a laugh out of it. Like, that's not
how that works. No, 100%. And it's like the motivation for watching horror with your kids is that you're there to like help them rationalize it and understand that it's not real, you know, like you're mm-hmm. the sounding board. And if they don't have that sounding board, it's just actually horrifying. Like, it's context that like is not okay for them. So 100%.
Well, I think, you know, this was such a great way to end our The Kids Are All Right series, since it is explicitly a horror film that not only, you know, follows children, but reduces us back to a childlike understanding of the darkness, or, you know, natural fear of the darkness, which I was really thankful for. And like, even now I'm like in my office, I have a lot of my wigs on the walls because of my cosplay, and like I could see them in the mirror, and one of them very much just looks like a very tall man, and that's freaking me out like so bad. Yeah. So I can't wait for this episode to be over so that I can turn the light on.
Me too, turn every man. Light on
in my house. And I hope that you do watch Skinamarink, and if you did, I hope it activated that thrill of fear that comes with the unknown. And it made you do that run to the bathroom where you turn on the light and you close the door, and how you don't want your foot to come out of the covers and hang off the bed just in case.
Yeah, no, I'm like freaking myself out now watching the background of my own video, feeling like there's stuff there and it's freaking me out. So I can't wait to turn the light back on. Yeah. It looks like stuff is there, Gabe.
It does, it does. I was watching you the whole time and I was like, your closet's pretty dark over there.
Stop.
I'm sorry.
Stop.
So
the dancing darkness hallway is here.
Oh, I can't. I'm afraid of my own damn hallway. I'm 31 years old. Got me afraid of the dark. I'm just very thankful to Kyle Edward Ball for creating something so peculiar. And there has been like this resurgence of kind of experimental horror, just unsettling horror. Like I think of We're All Going to the World's Fair and some of those films mm-hmm. like that. And so, yeah, if you have recommendations for films similar to this, if you know that I'm a big horror of found footage or just weird footage films, definitely let me know. Would love to hear about them. It triggers all the good parts of my horror senses for sure. And mm-hmm. yeah, definitely check it out. Let us know what you think of the film. What are your theories? What do you think it's actually saying? Because you're right and you're also wrong. And I love that. Yeah. So, yeah. Well, this is the end of our Kids Are All Right. We got a new series coming for you next month. And we will have the lights on when we do it.
Yeah, the whole time. Promise.
You'll be able to see our faces for real. So, yeah. Don't get married.
Delete your kids.
The darkness will come for your children. What a nightmare.
Terrifying.